Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the ongoing battles between states to attract businesses and prosper, there's been a big disagreement over the best strategies to achieve this. On one hand, business surveys have long noted that a well-educated workforce is a top-rated factor for a preponderance of business executives, and proponents for higher education funding point to this. The other argument is that lower taxes, incentives for companies to expand or relocate, or decreased regulations or a lower minimum wage works best. Well, which does work best? My guest today is a co-author of a report which examines educational attainment with wage income, and they state that education is the smartest state economic development policy around. Peter Fisher is the research director at the Iowa Policy Project. He is a national expert on public finance and has served as a consultant to the Iowa Department of Economic Development, the state of Ohio, and the Iowa Business Council. He's a co-author of a report for the Economic Analysis and Research Network, which examine the best ways to increase state prosperity. He's also the author of the recent book, Grading Places, What Do the Business Climate Rankings Really Tell Us? It's out in its second edition. He joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Peter Fisher, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm glad to join you.
In your paper that you co-authored for the Economic Analysis and Research Network, which examined best ways to increase state prosperity, your takeaway is that the best way for states to do that is to create a well-educated workforce. Now, while that may seem a no-brainer to many people, states today are employing a wide range of approaches, from lowering tax rates to economic incentives for companies that expand or relocate in their state to public infrastructure investments that can benefit business. Did you compare approaches, or did you look at it from an educational standpoint?
We did compare, and in this paper we focused mostly on education, but the role of taxes and incentives in economic development is something I've been looking at for about 15 years. And it's pretty clear that this trend towards states doing economic development policy as capturing jobs from other states, that's a trend of the last 30 years, and it's pretty much the sole focus of state economic development policy. When they think about what should we do for economic development, that seems to be all they can think of today is to cut taxes, provide more kinds of incentives, and hope that convinces firms to locate in your state instead of the neighbors.
Well, let me ask you a sort of basic question. What best defines state prosperity? I think you in your report used wage income, not total income or the state equivalent to GDP, if you will, the total number of dollars generated in the economy of the state. Why was wage income the best measure?
Well, the goal of economic development policy ought to be, and in some states explicitly is, to create greater prosperity among the state population. And that means higher wages, but higher wages broadly shared throughout the economy. If you look at growth in output or state GDP or just jobs, you can have that kind of growth without increasing state prosperity. You know, why would states want to do that? The focus ought to be on making the state a better place to live, making it a place where businesses want to come and hire well-educated, skilled workers and pay them good wages.
Well, let's look at what you found. How did you look at education as being a boost to the workforce, to overall wage gain? You found that high-wage states are states with well-educated workforces. What are some of the measures you went through in looking at state prosperity?
Well, there's a link here between education and productivity, and then between productivity and higher wages. And productivity is a prerequisite to an economy and a population becoming more prosperous. If you're going to raise the standard of living for the average person, you have to raise level of economic activity that one person can produce, or the value of output that they can produce in a year, and that's really what productivity is measuring. So we found a pretty strong correlation between states that increased the average educational attainment of their populations over a period of time and the state's growth in productivity. And we found a link then between states that increased productivity more had higher growth in median wages. So we focused on median wage. That's, you know, half the population earns less, half more. That's a better measure than the average wage, because you could have all the income growth in the state going to your state's equivalent of Donald Trump or Bill Gates, and the average would go up, but you know, the other 99.9% of the population wouldn't be any better off.
Of course, when we look at median income, it's been pretty stagnant for, gosh, a number of years overall.
Right. Overall, wages have not grown a lot, and that's a problem nationally in terms of how the gains from economic growth are shared. And the fact is that on a national level, you know, across the country, they haven't been shared. Most of the vast majority of gains in economic growth have accrued in higher incomes for the top 1% or 5% of the population.
But one of the things your survey does is it looks at where you see growth in a better educated workforce, and with that, you do see wage growth, correct?
You do, and that's a very, very strong relationship. We looked at state tax policy versus growth, just a simple correlation. You really can't see any relationship at all. The next graph, if you look at the percent of the workforce with a college degree versus the median wage, it's not just a strong relationship, it's a very consistent one. So it's pretty hard looking at that graph to figure out or to see any state that's achieved a high-wage economy without a well-educated workforce. And there's only a couple of states that have relatively high wages without a highly educated workforce. And those are a couple of natural resource states that have recently been benefiting from the boom in oil and gas.
Alaska, for example.
And North Dakota.
And North Dakota, yeah.
And
I was going to say, over time, the only time that's really prior to 1979, that was not as true, but Michigan, Ohio, the heavily unionized states, West Virginia with coal mining, those were sort of outliers as well.
That's right. Actually, it was Alaska and Wyoming, North Dakota. But you're right. In a previous era, when manufacturing was stronger, when there were a bigger share of the blue-collar workforce was unionized, paying good middle-class wages, it was possible to have a relatively high wage economy without having a lot of population with college degrees. But that doesn't, you know, 30 years ago that was the case, but that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. There doesn't seem to be a good road to a high wage economy without a more educated workforce.
Well, one of the things you looked at as well, in addition to the idea of educational attainment and high wages in a state, was looking at the correlation between taxes and high-wage economies. And you found no correlation there. And in fact, it was really kind of interesting if you could do a moving sort of a graph which would show, you see these states with varying tax rates and high wages, and some are low-tax states with low wages, and some are high-tax and low wages, and some are high and both high. But when you move that correlation back to educated workforce, everything moves into a line, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. You know, the graph showing the lack of relation between taxes and wages, it's not that surprising to me, because when you focus on tax policy as your economic development strategy, you really don't have much leverage. You don't have much to work with, because state and local taxes are less than 2% of business costs. And so you could have a drastic cut in one business tax and still not make much of a change in how that business views your state versus another state as a location. Because other things like wages, and energy costs, transportation are going to be much more important.
Why do you think states are turning to state taxes as a way of creating state prosperity? Is this a just misguided notion, or what exactly?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's probably not a simple answer to that. I think it is misguided. I think it's consistent with an ideology that says that government can't really do anything productive, so we cut taxes we have to cut government services, but that's fine. It doesn't affect the economic productivity or growth. And that philosophy, I think, has driven this policy in a lot of places. And we're arguing that, in fact, this kind of race to the bottom, tax-cutting, government-shrinking strategy ends up impoverishing higher education, in particular education in general, K-12 and preschool education as well. So we're using a short-sighted attempt, a strategy for gaining jobs at the expense of neighboring states, and in the process undercutting our ability to finance what's really important to the long-term growth of the state, and that's the education skill levels of the workforce.
My guest today is Peter Fisher, the research director for the Iowa Policy Project. He's also the author of the 2005 book, Grading Places, What Do the Business Climate Rankings Really Tell Us? And he's a co-author of a paper for the Economic Analysis and Research Network, which examined the best ways to increase state prosperity and found out of several approaches, a well-educated workforce is probably the key to state prosperity. Now, this may have been a little bit beyond your scope, but can we talk maybe about the investments in education within a state correlating with a better educated workforce? Because as you well know, state educational reform is a big hot button issue in a lot of states right now, especially since 2008 when state budgets were really strained. Is there any correlation there? Was that beyond the scope of your study?
We didn't get into that very much. We do cite some research indicating that, in fact, state investments in K-12 education do lead to better educational outcomes. I think the larger focus of this paper was on post-secondary education, and I think there that the trends have been very clear. There's been a very substantial withdrawal of state funding from post-secondary education, community colleges, and four-year institutions over the last decade. And we're really moving away from the public education model to one where it's more like private institutions, where the students pay most of the cost of their education. In Iowa, we've seen that the role's reversed in just 10 years, from the state picking up 60% of the cost in tuition, 35%, to about the reverse. And that story has been going on across the country.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other approaches that states take. We mentioned lowering taxes, and of course we know that that does put a serious crimp on other state services, because if you lower tax rates, lower revenue, there's less money for education. But oftentimes states will look at economic incentives for companies expanding or relocating. Did you examine how that works?
Yeah, I have looked a lot at that. And most of the incentives are similar to, the tax cuts that we talk about. I mean, it's sometimes hard to tell a tax cut from an incentive. We're talking about business tax cuts, often, probably most of the time, the whole justification for it is that we're creating an incentive for growth. So it's an across-the-board income tax cut versus an investment tax credit. One's an incentive, one's not. It's all a part, I think, of the same policy. And, again, the problem is you don't have much to work with. Most of these incentives are operating through the tax code, so it's a tax credit or a rebate in property taxes, and you just aren't going to affect most business decisions by doing that, but you are going to cost the public treasury a lot of money by doing that, because you will give the incentives to everybody who qualifies, even if 90% of the time the business would have done what they're doing anyway. So it ends up being a very costly strategy with not much effect on job creation.
I want to ask your opinion on something, because, within the last 10 to 15 years, there have been a series of high-profile plant relocation searches that have gone on, everything from GM creating Saturn, that must be over 20 years ago, to the Boeing Superliner, where these big multinational companies, huge companies, were pitting states against each other for the best incentive package for them to put a factory there. Do you think that has had an effect on how legislators view business relocation and the reasons businesses do relocate to a particular state?
Well, I think those high-profile cases had a lot to do with the way legislators and governors view the economic development world and how they have to compete in it. And I think they're convinced that that's the way the game is played now. Just taking a recent example and to see where this has ended up and taken us, I mean, our state recently gave over $200 million in incentives to a company that's going to create 160 jobs. And we're talking about a need to create 4,000 jobs every month in order to get back to where we were before the recession and create the kinds of jobs we need for the expanding workforce, 3,000 jobs a month. So we're spending $200 million on 160 jobs.
Man, that's highly subsidized.
That's a huge amount per job. And then we turn around and congratulate ourselves for freezing tuition for the first time in 10 years, still leaving it way above what it used to be at community colleges and four-year universities. So there's a direct line between these kinds of expenditures on incentives and the argument that we can't afford this or we can't afford that. If you start shrinking state budgets, you can't do it without cutting into education, because that's over half the budget in most states.
Well, one of the things your report does look at negatively is the idea of providing incentives for companies to expand or relocate. And, of course, here in this very week, there was stories of Texas Governor Rick Perry going on the airwaves in Missouri to lure businesses to Texas. And one of the things you say is this doesn't increase productivity, which you cite as a major gauge for increasing wages and state prosperity. But I have to ask you, productivity doesn't always, lift all boats. Productivity has grown greatly over the past generation, which you acknowledge in the report, but wage growth has largely been anemic. How do you make sure that education-based productivity gains translate into higher wages?
Well, that's a rivet question. And we talk about that a little bit in the paper, but clearly, as you say, the gains from productivity recently, on average, have accrued largely to those at the top and have not produced this broad increase in wage growth. And having said that, the states still need to fulfill their basic responsibility here, which, if you're looking at economic policy from a national perspective, the federal government has to keep full employment or try to do that. Investing in R&D is something the federal government's heavily involved in, but education is primarily state responsibility. There are also, when we look at how to make sure the gains from productivity are shared, there are also some major federal actions that are going to have to take place for that to occur, including restoring greater progressivity to the tax code, making it easier for labor to organize. I mean, one of the fundamental trends we're talking about here is the fact that the share of national income going for wages and salaries, going for paid work, has been declining for 20 years, and an increasing share of it is being captured in profits, interest, rent, capital gains, the incomes of the top 1% or 5% of the population. And you can draw a pretty direct line between the decline in share of the workforce that's unionized and increasing income inequality. And that's something that states can address to a degree as well. Certainly, they have a role in enforcing wages and hours laws, for example. There's obviously a move to for states that are not so-called right-to-work states, move to becoming right-to-work. And you know, people should recognize that that is going to produce, in the long run, more income inequality in that state and lower wages. A pretty clear relationship. So, yeah, there are some things the state can do there to try to make sure the gains from growth are broadly shared. But certainly, you know, certainly at a minimum, they ought to not give incentives to firms to create low-wage jobs.
I was struck by something you said about the progressivity of federal taxation. You know, in a lot of states where they are cutting taxes, and especially income taxes, for example, the tendency is always to cut the top rate. I'm wondering if a better approach might be to stretch the brackets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, if you really want to give a tax cut, stretching the brackets gives a tax cut to more people, maybe less money per person.
Yeah, that's right. And if your brackets are indexed, then they automatically stretch every year. But in a lot of states, they are not. I think the movement also in many states over the past couple of decades has been to increase the most regressive tax at the state and local level, which is the sales tax. And if there are cuts to be made, they're always looking to cut the income tax, which is generally the only progressive component of the state tax system. So those who would argue for a flat income tax, my question to them would be, if you favor a flat tax system where everybody pays the same proportion of their income, we ought to be favoring an increase in income taxes and a cut in sales tax, because the overall state and local tax system is not proportional. It's not a flat tax. It's regressive. The more income you make, the lower the rate you pay.
Yeah. My guest today is Peter Fisher, the research director at the Iowa Policy Project. He is a co-author of a paper for the Economic Analysis and Research Network, which examined the best ways to increase state prosperity. He found that the better educated workforce is probably the key to state prosperity. I was struck by something you wrote in the report that says, you know, state officials ask why invest in more college graduates, especially, I would think, over the last 4 years when we've had a surplus in the job market, if jobs for those graduates are not readily available. What do you say to a state official making that argument?
Well, one of the leading experts nationally on the whole issue of economic development policy, Timothy Bardick at the Upjohn Institute in Michigan, has done some research and found that, in fact, when you increase the labor supply, the demand for those kinds of skills, in this case educated workers, will increase by at least, he says, two-thirds of the supply increase. So we create 100 more college grads, we're going to get at least 65 or 70 more jobs for college graduates. And so in a way, he's arguing that if you educate workers, the jobs for educated workers are more likely to come to your state.
If you build it, they will come. Appropriate for somebody from Iowa.
Right.
Well, in our last couple minutes, I want to ask about your book that you wrote a few years ago, Grading Places, because, you know, this is the time of year when I just received a tax foundation looking at the combined state and local taxes. And one of the things you did in that book was look at a variety of rankings for these think tank rankings of what the business climate is in a various state. And one of the things you found was that, first of all, there's a common agenda of those organizations. They all want small government, lower taxes, and no commonality, so that nearly every state could simultaneously claim a great business environment if their policies were, you know, that favored by that particular review, or a lousy environment simultaneously. Has anything changed since you examined that?
No. In fact, I did a new edition of this book just earlier this year. I looked at a couple of more attempts at ranking states that have come out. And it's true, the same state will advertise what a great business climate and a great tax climate and all the incentives they have when they're trying to recruit businesses and cite rankings that reinforce that position. And then when it comes time to consider legislation, they'll look at the other rankings that show what a terrible business climate they have and why we need to cut all our taxes. So, yeah. There are fundamental problems with those state tax rankings, and my main argument, I guess, is they just ought to be ignored.
And yet, anytime they come out, there's usually media outlets that will go for that because, you know, everybody wants to know how you're ranked. It's interesting, you know, President Obama is trying to do that with education. You think the same biases will come into place in a federal college ranking?
Well, I think what he's trying to do is something a little different, and I don't have a problem with taking one measure, and it might be years to, or semesters to graduation, or percentage of graduates who find a job within 18 months, some measure like that, and just showing how each university ranks on that one measure. The problem with these business climate rankings is they'll take 20 or 30 or 40 measures, widely disparate measures, and mash them all together and claim that the result is somehow measuring business climate and the attractiveness of your state. And there's so much mischief hidden in that process of mashing all those different measures together and picking them in the first place that the end result is meaningless. And it's far too easy to stack the deck by selecting certain measures to come up with your index of competitiveness. And nobody really knows what it's measuring, and so they just say, oh, okay, we're not competitive, or we are competitive.
Well,
the president's doing something quite different, looking at just one measure at a time, as I understand it.
Well, Peter Fisher, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Peter Fisher is the research director at the Iowa Policy Project and author of Grading Places, What Do the Business Climate Rankings Really Tell Us? He recently co-authored a paper for the Economic Policy Institute's Economic Analysis and Research Network, which examined the best ways to increase state prosperity. If you'd like to read the full report, visit the Economic Policy Institute's website at epi.org and search for A Well-Educated Workforce is Key to State Prosperity. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa on the pull-down menus, and you can search our archives. Hope you have a great Labor Day holiday. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.